नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं नमं संघं नमस्सामि। One of the challenges of giving a talk, talking about Buddhism, is there are so many interesting bits in it. It's like looking at a kind of a casket of jewels. And you can see this is a really interesting bit, and this is a really interesting bit, and there's hundreds of these really interesting bits. But also, one of the most interesting bits is they all fit together. You know? And so, you know, there's the sense of the integration of it all, the way that all these things like, you know, samadhi and mindfulness and loving kindness and virtue and generosity and release and non-attachment, all these things, any one of them, which is a skillful and wonderful treasure, they all kind of bind together. They all form a unity, and often for convenience people kind of divide it up into, well, there's teachings on morality, teachings on karma, teachings on meditation, and there's different kinds of meditation, there's samatha meditation and vipassana meditation, and then there's so many stages, and then there's wisdom, you know, so you divide it all up, and because that does enable you to kind of scrutinize one feature, but it unfortunately it does give, you know, make one lose the sense of the unity of it all. So you can start to even quibble over, you know, whether you do samatha or you do vipassana, or how much, how good your sila, your morality has to be before you can, you know, and so forth, or whether you should do loving kindness or whether you should do mindfulness of breathing. So you kind of get into these confusions around it. It's like a whole body, you know, that fits together. So even the Buddha, in one of his last tour of teachings, he did kind of go around, you know, categorizing it to a certain extent, saying on his last, when he knew he was dying, he spent his last few weeks or maybe a few months or so going to every monastic settlement and every place we knew people were, his supporters were, and giving a talk. And every talk he said, this is sila, this is virtue, this is samadhi, this is the process of concentrating, meditating, and this is panya, this is the process of seeing or witnessing or knowing. So he kind of, and he made it emphatic. He made these three particular qualities, you know, and that's been the kind of the way the tradition has kept the Dhamma in these three categories ever since, based upon that. But I'd like to also point out that what you learn in cultivating virtue is what you learn and what you develop in cultivating meditation and concentration. Mm. And the results of that are wisdom. Mm. So it's, you know, that all three actually do fit together. And we can look very broadly speaking at every practice, however kind of mundane it may be. There's first of all the doing of good, or what's bright, what's called bright karma, something that gives rise to a fortunate result, something that feels good and has long-term good effects, and is coupled with the sense of there's a freeing that occurs with it. There's a knowing that occurs with it. There's a deeper, fuller quality to awareness that occurs with it. So these two features, both we have a brighter, more fortunate quality of feeling or tonality to our minds, and also there's a fuller and more sensitive quality of awareness. These two, you've got to get the two together really, because of course everyone is looking for happier feelings, but they don't necessarily always look for them by becoming more fully and subtly aware. Some of our ways we seek pleasant feelings to become more oblivious, you know, to just saturate ourselves, or to get less subtly aware, but actually intoxicated or overexcited, or so forth. So it's these two together, the quality of, you might say broadly speaking, happiness or well-being, and the quality of a liberated awareness. And you learn this, because this has to be really learned and ingrained, and seen as something that you can carry forth all the time. So you really get a sense of really respecting it. It's not just a once a week job. It's not something you just can only do when you're on retreat. It's something you find is the natural way where you feel most balanced, you feel most properly yourself, you feel most integrated in. Yeah. So why bother with virtue at all? You know, and in the time of the Buddha, there were teachers who said, "Well, it doesn't really matter, you know, because there's no real self and there's no consequences, and it's all just empty elements coming and going. So whatever, you do what you like, because it doesn't really count." You know, they said you can run up and down the north bank of the Ganges, slicing everybody to pieces, and up and down the south bank of the Ganges, chopping and hacking, and it doesn't really matter because there's no abiding soul or entity, there's no moral law. Kind of nihilism. And this is, of course, you know, very, very coarse, perhaps even exaggerated example. But it's also the case that you know, many people don't really take themselves that seriously, you know, that what you think and say actually has effects. You know, immediate effects that you will receive. So if you actually do bring forth a good thought, okay, it doesn't mean you're going to win the lottery or, you know, meet the ideal person in your life, but for that particular moment, there'll be some sense of an alleviation of pressure or tension or stress. Yeah. It's really so there's a kind of a requirement both to cultivate the good and also to notice the effects of it. What does good mean? You know? Is it just conforming to somebody else's rules or laws? Behavior, otherwise you get punished. Yeah. Or is it something that actually makes you feel brighter, clearer, enhances your options? Because instead of being taking part in some compulsive action, you're actually making a free choice to do something that has got a psychological effect of uplifting, you know, gladdening, and so forth. And you really need to kind of contemplate that. So, you know, virtue doesn't exist really separate from meditation. I mean, you actually got to have awareness of what you're doing to really complete the experience of virtue. Otherwise, it can just be going through the motions of doing what you think you're supposed to do, or what you feel other people will approve of, or what it says in the book, or what you think, you know, if you don't do, you get punished. So even if you're doing good actions, actually not doing the right reasons. You're not actually deepening and enhancing awareness. So you're not taking that in. So it's important to really know what you're doing and to get a feeling of what happens. So there's a strong sense of what's called Dhamma Vijaya, or investigating or fully appreciating these psychological experience or spiritual experience. This is an enlightenment factor, a factor of awakening. You take your mind seriously, not in a grim way, but like, what's actually happening? And this is important. This is a big step, actually, because in doing that alone, already you're coming out of the just being a cog in a wheel, where your life is to fulfill quotas or functions or get things done or make a wage or something, where you're doing something for external reasons. You know? And the idea is you get paid for that, so you get a kind of, you get some recompense. But actually, in terms of the quality of what really counts, our lives are spent giving ourselves away, not really dwelling in the heart and learning and growing. You know, we get a lot of instructions on how to be an engineer or a chemist or a lawyer or a cook or whatever, but to be a human being, you know, is sometimes it takes a long time before you really know and learn how to be a full human being. You know, this is, in a way, you could say, simply what Buddhism is about. You know, really taking up the instructions on how to fill yourself and feel fulfilled in being a human being, rather than just a function or, you know, somebody who a statistic, where eventually life becomes rather meaningless. You know, you're one in 10,000 and you go and somebody else takes over, so what? You know, what was your life about? So you have to matter, it has to matter to you. You have to matter to yourself and take time and know what really is going to do you good is this cultivation of the mind. That's what's going to stay with you day in, day out for this life. And at least the strong encouragement from the Buddha is it's going to go on for another life too. You know, you can take that on trust, or you can at least say, well, what if it does? If you don't believe it, but bear that in mind, you know. But anyway, it's going to go through this life. And, you know, what's going to be there when the chips are down? You know, when the economy goes belly up, or you get sick, you know, you get old, you know. Which is not if, it's when. What do you got, you know, at the end of it? Unless you've really taken this opportunity to develop. And this is actually not a kind of massive development, it's a turning. So just a turning of a few degrees. Rather like, you know, turning an oil tank. You turn it a few degrees and eventually it's going to go a very different direction than if you didn't turn it. And it's making the effort to do that turning every day, that 2 or 3 degrees. What about what's happening to me? What's happening here? And what's really assessing, you know? What were the activities that I took part in today and what's the result of that? What did I talk about today and what's the result of that? What did I see today and what's the result of that? What did I bring forth today and what's the result of that? There's a kind of stigma against judgment. You know, but here we're not judging ourselves as good or bad. We're actually just trying to assess, you know, causes and conditions that are occurring. This is not saying, you know, I am this or I am that, but these particular experiences lead to this, that particular experience leads to that. this experience, if handled that way, goes this, feels this, it's like that. You're just really sampling the stuff of life, because this is, you know, where you can learn, isn't it? So for that, you're really encouraged to say, well, to learn, you want to get some good standards in here. Some standards that are, not just esoteric or refined or a matter of opinion, but things like, things that are pretty obvious, like harming things, things that immediately I wouldn't want to have happen to me. That's a good standard. I wouldn't like anybody to beat me up or harm me or malign me or gossip about me or backstab me or be sarcastic or cynical about me. The harming of the speech, harming of the body. I don't even like to think somebody's sitting there mentally hating me. So we see that virtue is actually a little more than just what you say and what you do, but it's more than just precepts. It's also extending it to the quality with which one lives one's life, the ethical quality of it. What would I like to be involved with? What would I like to be part of? I'd like to be part of generosity rather than stinginess. I'd like to be part of sharing rather than hanging on. I'd like to be part of tolerance and patience. They feel good. I'd like to be part of courage and being reliable. I say something, I'll do it. I'd like to be part of being honest. And to do that, it means there's a certain kind of responsibility to live that out. And if these things make sense to us, we think, yeah, that is good. You have to recognize the very fact that when I even think of these terms, something in me says, well, yeah, that is good. That's the way. That means that actually, essentially, we do have we're ethically attuned. This isn't something you just get indoctrinated into. We are naturally ethically attuned. We know. But sometimes we don't bother to know, or we kind of shortchange ourselves, or we get kind of cut corners, or it doesn't really matter. Or we act impulsively, or we react. Or you think, who cares anyway, And these kind of corruptions or cramping of the heart, we get frightened, we get defensive, we get flustered, we get hurried, we get pressurized, and somehow this ability to be coolly aware and make deliberate choices about how we extend our energies gets lost because, we're in a bit of a panic, low-grade, manageable panic, rushing from this to the next, to this thing, get this done, sort this out, or anxiety, what if, better make sure that's okay, and sort that, So we lose the sense of a supervisory awareness that's saying, what's the quality of this? Eventually the quality doesn't count anymore. Get it done. This is really important to just be able to say, well, this is my life. I'm going to be responsible for this, the results of this. So it's really important that I'm going to be responsible for how I act. Because I'm going to get the results of this. So just to start to kind of check those messages that are saying, don't look, don't think, don't worry, don't be conscious, just rush, be compulsive, just get this done, get on with it, don't waste time. Where are they coming from? Don't waste time, What's that mean? I remember telling somebody about a very lovely Dharma cartoon I had posted up on the wall of the monastery. When for a while, it was beautiful. Because it started off and the first caption was this little, tiny little baby. And it says underneath it, much too young to meditate. Second caption, there's a little boy running around kicking football. says, too much energy to meditate. Next one is a teenager on a motorbike, scrambling, having too much fun to meditate. Yeah. Next one is a young man falling in love, too much in love to meditate. Then is a guy going to work, he's in his 30s now, too busy to meditate. Then it shows a man sitting in a 40 in front of his television, feeling really tired, too tired to meditate. And it goes on, and it's showing somebody kind of in late age, sitting there with a kind of blanket and shawl around him, shivering, too old and sick to meditate. And then there's a tombstone, too late to meditate. Gee, you know, whose life's that about? Yeah, do you want to be like, you know, it's grim, isn't it? And yet, those are words that can run through any of our minds. Oh, not right now, and I'm just busy, you know, too busy, this is too much, this is too nice, you know. And we're not talking about meditation necessarily as kind of some, even a formal exercise, but the quality of bringing yourself into awareness of what's happening right now. Do I have a choice? If I don't have a choice, I'm in trouble, actually. If I don't have a choice, then whose life is this? Who's running this show? You know, when I say a choice, I mean a choice where I can pause, reflect, respond to what's going on. You know, maybe I can't change the weather, but I can, you know, decide whether I'm going to go out or maybe I can't fix the car, but I can think, okay, I can learn to be patient. You know, I can respond to situations rather than just be compulsively engaged and reacting to them. That's the vital choice, isn't it? I can use every situation to cultivate a little bit more discernment, you know, balance. And what's the skillful response? What can I do with this one? Even if it's something really unpleasant, you know, like sickness, you know, well, I can cultivate patience. I can cultivate kindness towards myself, you know. So we're saying we want to be able to have that choice in how intimately, on an intimate level, we respond to our experiences. And this is the basis of cultivation. Whether you're doing this in terms of external activities, things that happen to you in a fairly coarse way, you know, distresses, problems, and down to things quite refined cultivation, meditative cultivations. And so we begin with realizing that there is an opportunity to, in our lives, whatever's going on, there's some opportunity to somehow, you know, lift the mind, make something good out of it. Even if it's just patiently bearing with something, or not blaming other people for it, or ceasing or avoiding anger, you know, when we are hurt or offended. So the quality may be quite painful, and yet we're not reduplicating that pain with something that gives us pain in the future. That's discernment, isn't it? Now, if there isn't that balance of awareness and discernment, then there's the reactions. You hit me, I hit you. You deserve it. You know, I want that, I'm going to get it. Great, I got mine, you know. We feel good for that moment. You know, a certain reactivity always promises and gives us a kind of flash of some kind of pleasure, satisfaction we might say, rather than pleasure, some satisfaction. I told him, or I told him where to get off, you know. Oh, I feel a lot better now. You know, so there is a satisfaction, isn't there? It's the kind of, you know, even something quite unpleasant. I mean, people, human beings, have always found cruelty quite satisfying. in a way, you know, weird, isn't it? And yet nobody, obviously people find violence and anger in some way, you know, is satisfying, or they wouldn't do it. This is part of the complexity of our minds, that's psychology. Yeah, is we can actually find degrading things satisfying, harmful things satisfying, spicy, menacing, you know, threatening, feeling really cool, you know, bullying, you know, feel really cool. Why? What's that about? Now, it's not that the immediate feeling is pleasant, but the sense of I am somebody, you know, the sense of solidity that comes with that has got this satisfaction, gives us the suggestion of satisfaction. And even in a kind of fairly harmless way, you know, people like to do this, you know. So people dress up in clothes that make them look tough, or, you know, stick spikes through their ears, or whatever. It must hurt. I've seen people with kind of 5 rings through their mouth, stud in the tongue, stud in the ear, stud in the eyebrows, you know, bone through the head. It must hurt, like, why do you do that? You know, it's a strange thing to do. And yet, you know, somehow I am somebody. I walk down the street and people look at me and go, wow, that's really cool. You know, well, you must be really tough or something. You know, you become something. And for a moment, I'm not just a kind of a hack clerk behind an office. I'm somebody who stands out. You know, I'm not just a kind of secretary in an office. I'm not just a kind of sweep in the street. I'm tough, I'm sexy, I'm a vampire, I'm Dracula, you know. You watch out when I come by, you know, I've got only half my head shaved, the other half dreadlocks. You know, look really terrible, frightens you. You know? And we like to go to horror movies, don't we, and get scared out of our wits. So, you know, this is a kind of... there's a pleasure or a satisfaction that comes from a sense of being something. Because often in life, if you don't actually have strong core values, it's really confusing. What am I? Who am I? Just a nobody? Just one in a million kind of average, boring old guy, you know? And then we can worry about maybe I'm not very attractive and just a dumpy old woman or something. So we, you know, you want to be special. So we kind of adapt. We pick up particular fascinations, obsessions, fashions, occupations. Some of them quite harmful. You know, people are taking themselves to cut themselves. This is a particular thing that's occurring in Britain. You know, teenagers actually just slicing into their bodies. You know. Somehow it gives some sense of psychological relief or something like that. You know. Or in religion, people flog themselves. You know, feeling for the cause, you know, martyr themselves. Because for that moment, I'm a hero. I'm doing it for the great cause. So be really careful about this particular form of satisfaction that arises from becoming something, being something. I use that term becoming because this is a very strong reference in Buddhism that sometimes is a bit enigmatic. What do you mean? You know, it means this sense of adopting an identity, picking up. We don't really know what we are, so we adopt something. And that hunger to adopt something for the sense of solidity, coherence, stability, status, whatever it is, you know, even if it's being the nastiest guy on the block, I'm somebody, you know, is a powerful compulsion that actually overrides the drive for ordinary pleasure. Yeah. This is something that beings, human beings do all the time. We will override our wish for sense pleasure in order to achieve some sense of self. We do this all the time. So sense pleasure, though it is a big pull for us, we get reactive and greedy and excited and fed up if we're not getting enough. It's actually less of a hindrance, less of a deeply entrenched obstacle than this hunger to be something, which can actually cause us to, you know, to physically hurt ourselves in order to feel heroic or we belong to the cause or something of this nature. And even in religious forms do that. The Buddha very firmly talked against this, asceticism, self-mortification. But it's not purely a religious thing. It goes right across the human spectrum as a feature of the human mind. The wish to be something, no matter what. So, you have to be aware of that, because when you cultivate, at first you've got no option really except to go along with this and to make the becoming something as conscious and as reflective and harmless and good as possible. So the first phase of our practice, though I wouldn't exactly say one comes before the other, but the first quality we might bring to mind is the sense of coming into something that is, feels nourishing, good, gives you results you want to be with, gives you results you don't regret later, gives you results you're not ashamed of, that you don't have to hide from yourself or others. Gives you a sense that really helps to makes you become something that feels you feel good with. And you feel good with in a consistent way, long-term good results. Maybe not even that scintillating as you do them. So the trend towards harmlessness, you keep generating that, which at first doesn't seem like very much, but as you keep generating, you begin to delight in the conscience and concern that arises. You feel how sweet the mind can be. To have that sense of conscience and concern, you actually get a sense of delight with it. Generosity, just to give, a piece of bread to a bird. Oh, that's nice. I like doing that. It's nice. It makes you feel good. Yeah, so you need to cultivate those trends within what you can manage, of course. Because we're not trying to become the superstar, but just becoming that has a long-term, comfortable, comforting effect that you can live with. And it's just I think certainly for myself, one of the great privileges I have of living in a training system is that there's so many trainings and pointers that may where you have the chance to do quite small things that build up a long-term result of feeling uplifted, feeling how beautiful the mind could be, how sensitive the mind could be, how you're sensitive to how you might affect someone, whether so you're careful about even joking about people. Make sure that it's really soft and light and, it's not coarse. How you talk about people. Do you need to mention somebody's faults all the time? No, I don't need to do that. Why don't you just make light of that? So you learn in the bhikkhu training a lot of skills on how to make the mind feel sweet and comfortable. Yeah. How to operate gently, how to think, what would be for this person's welfare? What would be, so we look after each other. It becomes a norm whereby the monks always look out for each other, try to support the senior monk, wash his clothes. It's a real training, you know, because young man, you don't do that. You don't wash your dad's socks. You know, it's up to your mum. You kind of, you don't even wash your own socks. You just give it to your girlfriend to do. But as a monk, you kind of look after your teacher, you clean the room, you wash their clothes, anything I can help you with, you know. And it's reciprocated. So you get into a lovely feeling of gentleness and gentlemanliness. And it's a kind of a lost art, because often, you know, as men you get encouraged to be a bit sort of, well, shove off, mate, you know, and I've got mine, and, you know, I'm looking after myself, and nuts to you kind of thing. I'm tough, I don't need anybody. And, you know, that's a bit miserable, isn't it, to not, you know, to have that kind of attitude, I don't need anybody. It's not about needing someone. It's, you know, we can share each other's lives. We can take joy in other people's welfare. Yeah, that's, you know, we're here in this together, so let's really enjoy each other in this simple, non-intrusive way. It's something to, I would encourage you, you know, develop the sense of community. This is virtue, you know, in a kind of non-righteous, non-moralizing way. Spreading, our nature is that our mind is naturally suffusive and spreads. So why don't we spread the spirit of goodwill and attention, you know? Particularly that sense of attention, because sometimes you don't know what you can do. You know, I want to help, what can I do? Actually, maybe what you need to do is just listen. You know, it doesn't have to be a big thing, but it's the main thing is you have that quality of awareness, and then you find there's a time when there's something you can do, or something you can stop doing, or you can be listening, or you can, you know. So it's always that mixture of the intent towards the good and this development of a subtle and expansive awareness. The results of that is that one is first of all liberated from heedlessness, and you respect that liberation, you value yourself because you're liberated from that. There's the liberation from long-term unfortunate consequences when you're kind of grumpy, alone, and you've just got grudges in your mind. You're liberated from that, and you get the immediate sense of, now I know what to do, I know which way to go. So you get some clarity. And you've also learned that the enhancement of awareness is not an intellectual process. It's not a complicated process. You know, it's not some kind of way out there, out in the sky process. It's very much the listening heart. Simple, often just empathic. So what we call awareness or knowing in Buddhism is not, you know, there's way you can, you know, you can use thinking, of course. But thinking is not the same as knowing. It's not about coming up with ideas. It's about having this kind of, we might say, empathic, sensitive ability to receive and respond. So even when you know, in meditation, you can actually stop thinking, and still that remains, that sensitivity, that balance, that knowingness still remains. In fact, thinking is a fairly clumsy kind of knowing. You know, big clunky thoughts come up, which are always only 50% true. You know, there's always something they miss out. Emotions are another kind of knowing, but they are also clumsy. Yeah. They're often got hidden agendas in the reactions, pits of personal history in them. It's unusual that we emotionally respond to something purely in the present. Generally, when we emotionally respond, there's a bit of the past comes in, you know, this is the way that you always are, you know, or this is what I think you want, or, you know, this is what I feel will be good for you, or this is what I think feels somehow is the right thing to do. So there's a little bit of second-hand knowledge going along with it. But awareness is actually very pure, fresh, immediate, and it receives and it generates some kind of response. Even the response is just to be still. Just to be still and listen. So you begin to learn this in cultivating virtue. Yeah. And there's plenty of opportunities to do that. We're in a world where things get hurt, and as human beings we can appreciate, and we can hurt each other, and we can also comfort each other very immediately. And we bring that to ourselves. So in the cultivation of virtue, and which includes things like kindness, compassion, it's not just moral precepts, it's a whole development of goodness, it's to others as to myself. Yeah. So when I've done something wrong, this isn't the time to start beating myself up. This is the time to think, what happened? Let's sit down for a minute. Let's check what happened. What causes and conditions generated that? How did you lose it? You know, it's not time to just go into the heavy blame trip or the guilt trip or the I am thing, where you immediately get some satisfaction out of beating yourself up, because there you are becoming righteous. And I've noticed this happen. You know, right, I'm going to stop doing that and stamp that out. Right. Tomorrow will be better, and then you lose it again. Because you haven't actually re-established full awareness. One has just adopted a moralizing stance, which for that moment feels satisfying, because now I am, you know. You know, now I am being righteous, now I am going to be more determined. Actually, the process of real learning, the I am gets in the way, a bit clunky thing that gets in the way. There's something more modest about really witnessing, wow, you know, greed is a pretty seductive thing, isn't it? Yeah, you know, it caught you. I was doing all right, and then I saw that strawberry, and before I knew what it was, boom, it was. You know, amazing, isn't it? So you really start to just, you know, really realize the power of these things. And okay, so a bit of building some strategy there, you know, something that's going to help with that. So you look after yourself rather than beat yourself up or make hopeless standards that you can't live up to and then fall down and then try again and fall down again, you know. So it's like that. We find then the cultivation of virtue does gives rise to a kind of subtle pleasure, which is the pleasure of feeling clear. There's a pleasantness about the mind when it's ethically balanced, and there's a pleasantness of sense that, hey, I you know, I'm not losing it. I'm with myself. I'm going in a way that I feel good about. Yeah. And the very quality of knowing, of awareness, is also pleasant in the sense that it's free from pressure. And so it has no particular, it's not pleasant because, you know, there's some pleasant thing happening to it, but the clarity, the unpressurized quality of awareness, the fact that it's open and free, is enjoyable. To have a free mind, to have a free heart is enjoyable. Even if that freedom is only for, you know, 5 seconds before we get caught in something. You start to learn that, and you know what the mind feels like when it's free, it's cool, it's unpressurized, it's open, it's also humble, it's modest. And then when it starts to get heated, or it starts to get contracted, You know, when we get either passionate with some kind of heat or drive, or we get contracted where it's, I am this, this is mine, this is what I'm, you know, when we start to become something, you know. As you know, people can get very nasty about goodness. You know, they get righteous. I'm the best person here. Nobody else washes up like I do. I wash up every night. You know, I'm the last person in the meditation. I always put the cushions away. What a good boy am I? You know, you lazy bunch of shirkers, not look like I am. You know, you know how to make something good into a disaster. Yeah, this is becoming. When you learn this, you see, it really, and you kind of use that as your basis. You really smell out those currents of becoming when they're starting to happen, when you're starting to hold on to something. And wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? Then, as you train yourself on that level, that's what takes you into meditation, you see. Because it's, you know, if you really want to enhance that and develop it, then what happens when I sit still and just be with the thoughts in my mind? Can I get that balance of letting go here, firming up there, lifting here, responding there? What happens when I just feel the sensations in my body? Can I cultivate that goodness there, that sense of awareness and true empathic response? Well, I'm just breathing in and out, you know. These are actually pretty, pretty massive things to do. These are impressive things to do. They're not easy. And I guess, you know, I don't know about you, but most of us, when we meditate, it's like you maybe sit there for half an hour, and probably 27 minutes of it is just scrambling round. You know, but at least you're kind of in the swimming pool, you're in there with it, and then occasionally, you know, you make a few good strokes, you know, well, that's pretty good, you know, you've got 3 good minutes in there. And in that half an hour, you could have done a lot of mischief, you know. So good, you know. You know, you didn't become the superstar, but at least, you know, there's a lot worse things you could have done in that half hour. And I've, you know, over the years, I've tended to adopt this kind of way of looking at my meditation, because then, you know, whatever else, I'm not doing all this, and at least I'm trying, you know. I'm trying, there's a willingness to try. And if I get to make the standards too high and I get critical and I can't do this and I'm a failure, I'm never going to get into this, and then, you know, the whole thing becomes so miserable that I only do it as a feeling of, I suppose, I've got to do this. You know, I'm a monk, so I thought I've got to meditate. You know, do me half hour, do me hour. Right, done it, that's it. Now I'm knocking off for the night, you know. Oh, goodness, come on, you know. Is this liberation or what's this? You make meditation to another stressful habit because you didn't become anything in it. But then the point is, when you cultivate, you actually find you're working with things like sense, this pull of the senses, pull of thought, the pull of ill will, the pull of doubt, the pull of worry, yeah, pull of dullness. And you're working with these things, coming out. And what you've got to realize is, as you to develop your awareness, just recognize every hindrance that occurs, every obstacle that occurs, that you don't actually believe in, for a start. You know, think, actually vindicate and sanctify, you know, which is the first step. Or you start actually following them. So every time you just don't even follow them, that you, something has grown there. You don't notice it because it's subtle. It's the quality of viveka, this, you know, just an inch of detachment, something has grown. So whenever you don't follow a hindrance, something has grown. Whenever you kind of, it drops in its intensity, you know, from feeling, you know, a lot of rancor into feeling just mildly cheesed off, you know, or you think, oh, it doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter, okay. just for that moment. Okay, now something has happened there, you know, which means you're not that train of thought, you're not that hindrance. There is wisdom there. And often we don't look or take in what is it that's actually arisen when the distress has stopped or lowered or weakened. What has picked up? There's been mindfulness. There's been a bit of mindfulness. There's been a little bit of investigation going on here. There's been some application. A little bit of effort's been made. Yeah? If you sit, you know, if you sit still for half an hour or so, that's some kind of effort, and you're making some kind of effort. So those are three very important enlightenment factors. Mindfulness, investigation, and energy. Just persistence. But they have to be appreciated. You know? It's like when your kid comes home, he's done a little drawing, you know? His first drawing of a cow, and it's got legs like a table, and it's got, you know, two horns on the same side of its head. You know, looks more like a table than a cow. It's the first time the kid's done it. You think, well, that's good. You know, you got the pencil and you stuck it on the paper, and yeah, it could look, you know, I suppose it's a cow. I see what you mean. You don't say, you idiot. You know, bring a photograph out, or look at Rembrandt, you know, you say, well, that's pretty good, you tried, and it's got four legs, not eight, that's good. You know, that thing underneath, that is an udder, yeah, I see what you mean, yeah, yeah. You kind of encourage the kid, and you say, well, hey, have you ever really looked closely at the ears, you know? Oh yeah, so rather than, you idiot, that's not very good. So you need to encourage it. So whenever you get a sense of actually being able to witness, well, this is me feeling a grudge and it doesn't feel so good. Good for you. You know? You've noticed something and it diminishes, or you get a pause between the thoughts. And if you encourage it, it starts to grow. Because you're bringing the power of the mind to bear and to highlight and to amplify these factors. It's like fanning the glowing coal. It's not I am something, but this particular condition has arisen. This particular experience has happened. Uh-huh. That's interesting. And it arose, you know, from me, or in me, you know. But it's not something you can make a self-image out of. So there's that sense in which your meditation is often just the courage and the persistence to determinedly work through, take an interest, and think, well, okay, we need some bit of kindness here. Just some stopping, checking, interrupt the flow of thoughts, get back to the body, doing this kind of work that we all do. It's grubby work sometimes, and it's seemingly ignoble. But this is the basis of our practice. And good for you. Yeah. And you begin to get that knowing quality a little more flexible and fluid. Now, what occurs whenever a hindrance, an obstacle drops, when the pressure comes off, which at first is quite faint, is a sense that the mind is just a little bit buoyant. You know? So whenever the kind of the compressions or the things that hold us down lift off, the worry stops, the agitation just for, or loose lessen, the mind lifts a little bit, it's buoyant. Oh, hey, I feel okay now. Lift, a little more energy. And this is the quality called rapture. Very important quality, because it begins to bring around a kind of quality of feeling that feeds the mind. The mind feeds on feeling. and perception. That is some meaning, you know, some meaning or value. You know, it feeds on those things. That's what holds it up. So instead of feeding on, you know, the pleasures that come from external sources, sense bases, getting one's own way or something like that, we get the quality that comes from, the feeling that comes from just the pressure coming off. You know, the jangliness dying away. And this is the quality of rapture. It's called rapture, it's lifting. And it starts off quite subtly. It's like suddenly you don't feel you're dragging a weight along, or you feel so kind of impacted by experiences. A bit more freedom. Now this is important because at this time what can occur is when the pressure goes off, the mind drifts. You know, suddenly, you know, nobody's giving me a hard time, my mind stopped jabbering at me, my knees don't hurt, you know, not worried about anything. Off in Lulu land, you know, daydreams. You see, so that it's the kind, then, you know, so you actually, why you need to firm up around knowing that feeling rather than just following it. This is the kind of, because the quality of rapture, particularly as you get more developed in your meditation, as meditation calms or quiets, itself is both a food, but like any other food, it can also be something that we get distracted by. We just gobble it and get excited by it, and we lose focus. So the first kind of obstacle to our meditation is unpleasant, you know, disagreeable, stress. The second kind of obstacle is actually pleasant, where we drift and we get excited, or we even think, oh, I really got it together now, you know, I am something. So it needs to something you actually need to develop this knowingness, sense of awareness of that. Oh, that's that. That's the condition that's arisen. This hindrance has passed. You're kind of sensing it out. How's my body feel in that? Breathing in, breathing out, how's that? And can it be relaxed? Because there's a kind of pressure that occurs when the mind is too bubbly. So can you just relax and ease that? So you get these two enlightenment factors also, rapture and ease. And as you handle them more carefully, more discerningly, with more objectivity, more detachment, it leads to samadhi, which is a stillness, a sense of everything's now gathered together, there's nothing to do, nothing to make, nothing to develop, nothing to become, nothing to get excited about. It's stop. And this is transformative. Because so much of what we normally sense ourselves as being is in terms of movement, and doing, and changing, and making something happen. Yeah? And in order to bring around that stopping, you have to have something you trust, because first it's kind of unnerving. You know? You know, it's quite a lot of your thinking is just to keep telling you you're still here. You know, it doesn't do anything, does it? It just goes, blah, 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 blah. What's it going here? It's saying, here you are, you're here, I'm still with you, you're all right, here we are. You know, it's just like reading comics. It does nothing except fill you up. But it can be very difficult to get out of that, because you feel kind of, oh, and then something comes in again, because it feels first of all empty to not be having all kinds of things going on. So this sense of encouragement to discern these enlightenment factors. So you think, oh yeah, there is something's going on called ease. That's what's going on. Can you feel it? Something's going on called one-pointedness. Can you feel that sense of strength and simplicity and stability? Ah, that's what's happening. So it's a kind of weaning into a subtler level. Where you experience that. And many of the tendencies and trends of the mind then become, you have an option. You don't have to think. You don't have to plan. You don't have to remember. Yeah? Rapture is helpful because it gives you the feeling this is coming from a good place. It's like I remember when I learnt to swim. You see, first you learn to swim, your dad takes you in a swimming pool. Okay, son, hold on. You hold on. You feel okay because your dad's holding you. Don't let me go, Dad, don't let me go. You'll be all right, don't let me go. Okay, well, there you go. So you feel you can only swim because your dad's got hold of you. Yeah. Or you've got one hand on the bar of the swimming pool, one leg on the floor of the swimming pool, so you're okay. If I take that foot off, I'll drown. And so when you do, of course, you feel uncomfortable and tight, so you do go down, you gobble, you know, because you're not balanced properly. And the way I learnt to swim, actually, was going to the sea, where there's a very gentle slope of the beach, and just lying right on the edge of the beach where the sea washes in. So as you lie there, and the sun was about, I don't know, 7 or 8, I suppose, and the sea would come, and just in that moment when the sea came, it would just lift a little bit, and it would go out again. Come in, and lift a little bit, and then go out. So you weren't kind of swept away, just a little bit lifting, and then the sea would recede, and you're firm again, and you learn to trust it. Think, hey, you know, that moment of lifting, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, I'm okay, you know, the body can do this. So your body relaxes and opens, and you can float. And that's how rapture develops to take you to samadhi. Otherwise it's too difficult to just try and stop everything. So it's a very graduated process. There's the pleasant quality of rapture, and above all, there's this sense of awareness, like your dad's there, you know, and he's not going to let go of you. You go down, he'll pick you up. So you have that real feeling of your practice is supervised by this sense of awareness, which you've cultivated from daily life activities, from ethical concerns, right through to your meditation. It's been something you've grown up with. So you trust it. It's never harmed you. It's never done you any wrong. You can trust it. And then you can actually allow the mind to stop. You've got something that will hold you. And you begin in samadhi. The issue really is now that you're not involved with external sense contact. The pleasures of the senses, you've got something else that you're enjoying. The real issue then is the sense of becoming, which remains in the satisfaction of becoming something, of being something. Here I am in samadhi or something of that nature. You know, which isn't necessarily thought, but it's a kind of feeling of it, a feeling of conviction and firmness and so forth. But when you keep contemplating that, and as you begin to sense how that actually is displeasing, it feels coarse, it feels hard, it eventually messes things up. You know, it takes the joy away, it takes the trust away, it takes the modesty away, and it doesn't feel so good anymore. Yeah. And this is how you begin to come out of this very powerful grip of becoming. You don't need to be anybody. And it leads to the last factor, which is equanimity, is a sense of just trust, evenness, not up, not down, just balance, like we're floating, even, an even mind. Quality called, the final level of detachment is called just release. Where there isn't some sense of being somebody who's made anything or got anywhere. This, of course, is a very that's difficult to conceive of. But I'll tell you that it begins right at the level of virtue, when we do good, but we don't pride ourselves for it. When we understand the harmfulness, the violence in our mind, but we don't castigate and dwell upon it. when we see and recognize the unskillfulness of other people, we don't stigmatize them for it. See, oh, there's these conditions and causes happening. You know? So all the time, you're not crystallizing qualities as solid beings. You do this for yourself, and you do it for others. And this is the way, right from the kind of most basic level, you lay down the foundations towards the cessation of becoming. And actually, this is the culmination of the path, the whole Buddhist path. But it begins right, step one, you know, and it goes right through. And you feel it. You feel the difference when there's no hanging on and no, you know, egotism involved. Things actually feel qualitatively freer and lighter. So I'll offer this for your reflection tonight. Just to recap, you have these particular point is that I'd like to you to remember every time that your a difficulty, a hindrance, it diminishes, watch what is there instead. There's something has arisen instead. Whether it's effort, energy, conscience, concern, kindness, mindfulness, something's been, really take advantage of that and highlight it. You know, try to look into, listen to the goodness in your mind that's breaking through this crust of habit and ignorance. If you've got any, of course. So, thank you for listening.
I have time for just one question.
Yep. Please. Give yourself a few minutes, but you know, you don't. I'm not rushing away, just moving. So if anyone has any questions, we're happy to sit here for the rest of the night if you like. Yeah. A time factor. A lifespan. As long as it takes, because if it's enjoyable, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Huh? Struggling. Yeah. Actually, you know, if meditation, if it isn't, you know, if it feels very slippery and difficult, it probably means you might look at a different way of meditating. Yeah. 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 You may have tried to start at step three. It's not that those things are wrong, but maybe you need to just kind of come back to step one. Yeah. I don't know quite what step one would be for you. It might be just learning to sit comfortably and bring to mind recollections that help to stabilize the mind. You know, recollections of the Buddha, recollections of one's mortality, recollections of goodness, recollections of the kindness of other beings. Something that gives your mind, your mind can quite easily get hold of. Yeah. So you don't want to pitch it too high and refined for the when you start. You know. You want to kind of, something the mind can quite easily pick up and takes it in, and then you can change it. You know. So you develop it. It's a form of, you know, you might say it's even just a form of hygiene, you know, mental hygiene. Just, you know, feeling like this, what's going to make me feel a little bit cleaner and brighter? And you sit there and, you know, okay, just think some good thoughts. So that gives your mind something to key into, and then move it from there, you know, awareness of the body. And very often you've got to sort of shuttle a little bit between the bodily and the mental experiences, just how they blend together, and how you can bring yourself into the present moment, which is not always that straightforward. Yeah. Well, okay. When your mind is thinking of the past, it's thinking of the past in the present, isn't it? Right? Obviously. Or it's thinking of the future right now. So we want to get into the present moment with that. We think, well, okay, rather than following the words and the thoughts, the present moment is this kind of energy of the mind. The mind is busy. So instead of, you know, getting scattered over the particular topics that you think about, where you might find it steadies you is just to feel, oh, this is a lot of energy here. Feel the energy. Yeah? Whether it's tight or busy or, you know, don't even just feel it. Then what's this feeling? Is it worry? Yeah? Or excitement? Not criticizing, just so you've got something that actually puts attention right onto the root cause, or as far as you can get to the root. So it simplifies things. Thinking mind scatters into manifold manifestations, and so it's very difficult to meditate if you get dazzled by them, or convinced by them, or fight with them. You know, because it's like trying to, it's a field of rabbits. But you go to just the one point, which is feeling restless. Okay, how does restlessness feel in the body? Do I feel a lot of energy up here? In my eyes? Is my mouth relaxed? Because often your eyes crinkle when you think a lot, or your forehead tightens. Okay, so can I relax the body a little bit? You know? So there's a sense in which you're responding to the thought and penetrating into the root of the thought, rather than just, you know, running around chasing the thoughts. Yeah. You might say the questioning is good, and the first question we need to ask is, where am I? Now, oh, sitting here, and then how am I now? Feeling unhappy, feeling happy, feeling a lot of energy, not much energy. Okay, so that simple thought that actually penetrates this blizzard of thoughts to just get to a point that your mind can, it feels like that. You know, you've got the one point. And then you can be, okay, now how can I make that just a little bit easier? You know. Breathe out, just breathe out. Oh, yeah. For 1 second it's easier. Then mind thinks again, okay, just do it again. You know? So you just, that little bit at a time, you keep penetrating the smoke screen of the future and the past, which is what it is. It's just smoke screen. Yeah. Thank you.